Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You can get a Batman action figure for about $25 retail. It cost that store $12 to buy it wholesale and $6 or so for Mattel to produce it at a factory in China. But after its second major recall in as many weeks, the country's biggest toy maker might be rethinking its production process. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by Bank of America, working to support a healthy planet, because the important thing is ensuring opportunities for all, today and tomorrow. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, the 14th of August. Glad you could be with us. One of the most important brands in the world has taken another big hit. Not Mattel, although today's recall will surely do some damage to its reputation. It's actually Mattel's supplier that may be in some trouble. Best guesses are 80% of all the toys sold in this country are branded Made in China. 9 million imported toys, from Polly Pocket dolls to Batman action figures, have been pulled from shelves. They've either got magnets that kids can swallow or they're coated with lead paint. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the latest problems aren't going to do anything to calm consumer anxiety over Chinese-made imports.
China may be the world's dominant toy maker, but former U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hill says perhaps not for long.
The Chinese producers are going to have to clean up their act, or they will have a reputation that will impede their progress, and our buyers here will look for other sources of supply.
Trade scholar Sherman Katz at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace says there are plenty of competitors elsewhere in Asia or Mexico ready to grab some of China's business.
Global sourcing is going to look again at whether the cost in image and brand damage offsets the labor saving. We're already seeing some manufacturing in other sectors moving to other places, Indonesia, for example, where the labor may be even less.
But Katz warns other low-cost countries might also have quality problems, giving U.S. importers incentive to work at improving standards with their Chinese suppliers. Mattel's CEO Bob Eckert today sidestepped a question about the cost of extra scrutiny.
We do not put a price on safety. We're talking about children, and I'm a parent of four. Increased testing, increased vigilance is just the cost of doing business.
Eckert said Mattel had supplied its own toy paint, but a Chinese subcontractor switched it for lead-based paint. Now Mattel will test not only the paint before it's applied, but recheck it afterwards. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Mattel shares gave up about 2.5% today. Could have been worse given the rout on Wall Street. Investors threw in the towel early this morning after disappointing earnings news from Walmart and Home Depot. That sowed fears consumer spending might be slowing down. Never a good thing, the analysts will tell you. For the most part, though, it was the financial sector people were keeping an eye on. The big investment banks like Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns. Everybody's waiting for the next shoe to drop as credit keeps getting tighter and tighter, and they didn't have to wait long today. Although that thudding sound you might have heard came from an unlikely source, Sentinel Management Group out of Northbrook, Illinois, runs funds that handle trades out of the commodities futures markets, or at least it did run those funds. The group said today it's going to stop letting investors redeem their shares until what it called the panic is over. Echoing the news from BNP Paribas of last week, Sentinel's having trouble figuring out exactly what those shares might be worth. Stephen Miller tracks what's called the leverage finance market for Standard & Poor's. Stephen, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen, this might sound like a really basic question, but how can it be that they can't value the assets they have?
Well, it's a very complicated thing. So normally a portfolio of bonds or stocks would be easy to value. You'd look at where things are trading on an exchange, they have an actively bid market, and every day and every minute, really, you'd be able to look at what the price is and come up with a value for your portfolio. But in these markets for structured finance assets, which tend to be a lot less liquid and they're not exchange traded, you often have to look beyond a simple price and go to a model or some sort of complicated analytical tool to be able to value them.
And so why can't they do that now?
Well, what happens is with structured finance assets, because they're not actively traded, often what you do is you mark them to where new issues are clearing in the primary market. So in other words, you would look at where a new mortgage-backed security is being sold to investors today to be able to then draw a comparison to the bonds you hold in your portfolio that might have been put into the market a year ago or 2 years ago. So when the new issue market breaks down and it seizes up like it is today, it's very hard to look at the new issue market for a price, and therefore it becomes enormously hard to value assets that have been outstanding for a while.
That's the function known as mark to market, right?
Exactly. And really, in these structured finance markets, mark to market is the kind way of putting it. Really what you're doing is marking to a model. And the model only works as long as there's data to feed into that model. And what happens is in times of dislocation is there's a lot less data, the data is less robust, and therefore it's much harder to mark the assets.
Dislocation sounds like a fancy word for the market's not working right.
Well, what I mean by dislocation, yeah, it is a fancy word for that. But really what we mean there is there's not a lot of new issue going on because people are struggling to come up with a price at which they buy the paper. So if you have a new pool of mortgages or credit cards or whatever the pool happens to represent, there's still a lot of discussion and a lot of what they call price discovery going on to decide where that pool would be placed with new investors today.
All right, let me make sure I understand this. Because of the credit crunch or liquidity squeeze or whatever you want to call it, not many people, not many groups are bringing new mortgages to the market, so you guys have no way of figuring out what they should actually be worth in a functioning market.
That's right.
How long is it going to take, and what's it going to take for people to be able to mark to these models or mark to an actual market effectively?
The jury's out on all that now. I think what it's going to take is some clarity around how high delinquencies get, whether housing prices have found a period of stability here or whether there's another leg to go on this correction. I think once all of the underlying assets get sorted out, then people will be able to much more confidently mark to market because you'll start to see new issue again that people can use as a peg to hang their existing portfolio on.
Care to spitball a time frame for me?
My best guess is you'll start to see that end of this year, early next year, that things start to settle out and stabilize and you have a new level that they reach in order to clear new deals in the new issue market.
All right, Stephen, thanks a lot. Stephen and Miller at Standard & Poor's LCD.
All right, thank you.
Oh, believe me when I tell you, you're not the only person who's had enough of market stories, but we've got a brand new one for you today. Not just a new story, but a new market. NASDAQ's launching the portal market tomorrow. About 500 companies will be listed. But before you rush out to make your first trades, Marketplace's Amy Scott has a couple of caveats.
First of all, you'll need at least $100 million in assets to trade on the new NASDAQ market, and the companies listed are privately held. That means they don't have to tell the public what they're up to. Analyst Brad Bailey follows the stock exchange business for research firm Aite Group. He says for years, investors who wanted to buy a piece of a private company had to pick up the phone and negotiate a price. Now members will be able to log on to a website, check the stock price, and make a trade at the click of a mouse.
This continues the evolution of the markets overall in the U.S., where we're going from a voice-based market where people are calling on the phone to more electronic tools. It should add some form of transparency to this market.
Some analysts say the reverse is happening. More companies are going private, in part to avoid regulations like the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms. Last year, companies raised more money by selling shares privately than on the public market. But analyst Stephen Brule with research firm Tower Group says a private listing is often a prelude to going public.
If companies stay private, then I think you could see some potential issues down the road, especially the lack of retail access to these investment opportunities. But oftentimes, the companies that are listing on the private markets will go public down the road.
NASDAQ's private exchange will have some competition. Earlier this year, Goldman Sachs launched a platform for trading unregistered shares. Next month, a group of five investment banks, including Merrill Lynch and Citigroup, plans to roll out its own private market. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Those old-fashioned markets on Wall Street resumed their triple-digit losing ways today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Everything's always easier in hindsight, of course, but you didn't have to be Warren Buffett to know that giving people loans for houses they couldn't afford might eventually come back to bite the overall economy. That said, there is a case to be made that we all really should have known better this time around. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more.
Listening to the financial news these days is like deja vu all over again. Here's what commentators were saying last week.
Ultimately, what has happened is people started to buy things that they weren't even quite sure anymore what they were. And as
the
result,
pundits had the same 2020 vision back in March of the year 2000 after the tech bubble started to burst. The get-rich-quick mentality that has fueled the housing run-up is not terribly different from the dot-com fever at the turn of the century.
They were taking companies public without profits, income. They were taking companies public that had no product. They convinced themselves that this was a new era rather than, no, this is crazy.
That's financial columnist Stephen Perlstein of The Washington Post. He says that same new era mentality made people believe that housing prices were going to keep soaring 20% a year and that anyone could handle a $500,000 home loan. Yale economist Robert Shiller wrote the book about dot-com era greed called Irrational Exuberance. He says investing in a dot-com company that had no business model is kind of like buying a house with a no-money-down interest-only mortgage.
So I think in some sense, at least, the housing boom is a continuation of the stock market boom with a different investment vehicle. Part of what happened in the 90s is that a lot of people discovered that their true inner selves were investors.
And personal investing has been made easy over the past decade thanks to an abundance of inexpensive credit. Financial columnist and author Carolyn Baum says that's created a perfect climate for run-ups.
Both bubbles were a response to periods of low interest rates. Bubbles do not end well. They don't. Whether it's tulip bulbs, real estate, they don't end well.
And yet, Steve Perlstein of The Washington Post says it's human nature to get lured in.
People kid themselves and fantasize, probably going back to Adam and Eve, and there's nothing you want to do about that or can do about that. That psychology is also important for the functioning of a capitalist system. You want people to be greedy.
Greed followed by fear. Economists say the markets are propelled by this cycle. But this time, the bust of the bubble could have a wider and more devastating economic impact. After all, houses are very different from dot-com companies or tech stocks.
That was just, you know, a lot of money that never was really there just disappeared. It evaporated. But that was investment money. This is about where people live, literally.
Or, in a growing number of cases in this housing market, about where they used to live. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Although it might sound like a contradiction in terms, there are business books out there that make for good summer reading. We've asked some of our commentators to send along titles that won't make you sleepy, just smarter, all while you dig your toes into the sand. Engineering professor Bill Hammack offers a nonfiction page-turner.
Thomas Barnett's book, The Pentagon's New Map, is a perfect confection of bite-sized ideas about our new global economy to nibble between dips. As I read this book, I rarely looked up for a second. See, this book gives you the blueprint for who determines our new world order. And it features the tribulations of a classic hero, Barnett himself, a Naval War College professor, bent on having American officials listen to his radical ideas. I mean, who could resist a chapter that opens with a mock ad reading, enemy wanted. Mature North American superpower seeks hostile partner for arms racing. Or an explanation of Marxism and capitalism featuring the hamburger-eating wimpy from Popeye. Barnett's New World Order boils down to states that form the core of the global economy on the one hand, and on the other, those that fall outside it, into the gap. Core states and their free people get to partake of the modern world economy. Gap states breed terrorism because without the benefits of a global economy, life for their people is nasty, brutish, and short. So our number one mission is to bring gap countries into the world economy. Forget fighting wars the old way, tank for tank and missile for missile. No, we must respond now with accountants. Take the Treasury Department. It's the warrior doing battle more and more by blacklisting banks and countries involved in terrorism. In Barnett's Brave New World, we use a double-fisted military force, a few Marines to fight the wars, and lots of new masters of the global economy. Lawyers, bankers, customs agents, and MBAs to wage the peace. You might quibble with how well the world will accept America as rule enforcer, but this racy, frothy read is right in its key theme. Understanding the military market link is not just good business, it's good national security strategy, too.
Bill Hammack is a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana. If you have a favorite beach book with a business twist, share it with us. We're posting listeners' recommendations on our website. It's marketplace.org. A couple of picks you've sent us already: Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe and Money Makes the World Go Round by Barbara Garson. Coming up, it's not just concert tickets that'll cost you.
Your program costs you some $50. A hot dog is going to set you back another $20. The whole evening will mount up to be the same as a sort of a small holiday, a skiing trip.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks tumbled again today as fallout from the subprime mess continued. The Dow Industrials fell 207 points, 1.5%, to end the day at 13,028. The Nasdaq dropped 43 points, 1.7% to 2,499. The S&P 500 slid 26 points, 1.8% to 1,426. Financial services stocks took a hit after that news from Sentinel Management Group we told you about. Fortress Investment Group dove more than 6.5%. Lehman Brothers fell more than 6.3%. Goldman Sachs shares dropped more than 4.3%. Citigroup fell nearly 2% after analysts said the credit market crisis could cost the biggest U.S. bank as much as $3 billion in the third quarter. Walmart down more than 5% after the company lowered its earnings forecast. Bonds traded higher today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for July. Visitors to the Thomas Jefferson Memorial get a pop quiz on presidential history. Correct answers will be rewarded with the newly minted Thomas Jefferson $1 coin. And fans and mourners gather at the gates of Graceland to commemorate the 30th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Bush administration has given a very big green light to the idea of making Americans pay extra to drive in congested areas. Today, the Department of Transportation offered New York City $354 million. The money would foot the bill for Mayor Michael Bloomberg's proposal. He wants to charge a special fee for cars and trucks entering the busiest areas of Manhattan. Supporters are selling it not just as a way to reduce traffic and air pollution. They say it'll improve the economy, too. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
If New York City had an official sound, this would have to be it. The city's average commuter wastes around 49 hours in gridlock every year, according to Transportation Secretary Mary Peters. Her department's funding offer gives Mayor Bloomberg some powerful leverage in trying to convince New York's city council and the state legislature to implement the plan. He'd charge up to $8 for cars, $15 for trucks during peak weekday hours. New York must meet certain traffic targets to get the federal money. Congestion pricing isn't a requirement, but Secretary Peters says she wants real reductions.
Unlike building new roads, this plan can be implemented quickly and will have almost an immediate impact on traffic.
Peters complains congestion in the nation's cities has kept on rising right along with transportation spending. The Big Apple's leading business group says there are hidden costs as well. Catherine Wild heads the Partnership for New York City.
We found more than $13 billion a year are lost from our economy because of traffic congestion, more than 50,000 jobs that aren't created every year.
Opponents argue the toll is a regressive tax that will hurt small businesses and fall most heavily on the poor. Walter McCaffrey has been coordinating the opposition. He wonders if the federal push for the idea will stop at the Hudson River.
Having been a member of the New York City Council for 16 years, we always like to think of ourselves as being the trendsetters. But this would be something that would be a very bad trend to set for the country.
McCaffrey also cites privacy concerns, calling the program a vehicle surveillance plan. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The governor of the great state of Nevada is in Mexico today. Jim Gibbons has been meeting with officials there to talk about trade and border security. Healthcare, too, how to pay for it when Mexicans working in the U.S. need medical care. From the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
A strange scene played out in Mexico this week, the wealthy neighbor seeking money from the poorer one. Governor Jim Gibbons has asked Mexico to help cover the health care costs of Mexicans living in Nevada, and Mexico's health department said it'll consider the proposal.
Fascinating. Every state in the country is going to be watching to see what happens.
That's Sherry Steisel with the National Conference of State Legislators. She says Congress was considering giving states $1.5 billion a year to help pay for health care and other social services for illegal immigrants. But that bill died in the Senate.
States around the country are very frustrated, and it doesn't surprise me that states are looking for alternate ways to help finance the costs of health care, education, and law enforcement.
So how much do states spend on undocumented immigrants? Peter Cunningham's a senior fellow at the Center for Studying Health System Change. He says a recent RAND study placed the health care figure at $6.4 billion a year.
It's actually a drop in the bucket when it comes to the total money that's spent on health care, which amounts to hundreds and hundreds of billions.
Cunningham says undocumented immigrants spend less on health care than most other people. That's because immigrants are often poor, uninsured, and unfamiliar with the U.S. health care system. Steisel says there may be a strange logic to Mexico helping lift the burden on Nevada and other states. It might convince Congress to finally pass comprehensive reform. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Never mind that David Lee Roth is 51 years old now. Van Halen, the band he helped make famous, announced plans for a 25-city tour this week. Starts September 27th in Charlotte, North Carolina, if you're a fan. In Europe this summer, though, some of the biggest names in music have been having a rough time. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London on Rockers in a Hard Place.
David Bowie, one of rock's shrewdest operators, spotted the problem some time ago. The golden age of record sales is dead. Downloading is done for CDs. Live music, said Bowie, is where the real money is. He urged his fellow megastars to follow the Bowie principle and hit the road. Ludo Hunter-Tilney of the Financial Times.
Bowie's idea was that in an age when music is permanently on tap, it ceases to have the same value that it used to have when you could shift it as vinyl or as CDs. Therefore, the way in which a performer can maximize their income is by going out to play live shows.
And boy, have they been going out to play live shows. This summer, some of rock and pop's most venerable acts have been practically bumping into each other on the road. The Rolling Stones, The Who, Genesis, Police, and the grandmother of them all.
Memories, like the corners of my
Barbara Streisand's money-making exercise has been the most blatant. Some of the seats at her British concerts cost $1,600. And yet in Britain, says author Neil McCormick, there was no shortage of loyal fans to fill the audience.
There were people sitting not only in front of her and to the side of her, but behind her, you know, who've paid at least £100 for the privilege of watching the back of her head, in which case you need to be a particular Barbara Streisand obsessive or else a hairdresser.
The way we were.
But that was Britain, where pop music is a national obsession and people love to splash their money around. In continental Europe, it's been a different matter. When Streisand crossed the English Channel and tried to sell her tickets at up to $750 a pop, she got a cool reception, says Ludo Hunter-Tilney.
In Paris, she played to a pretty thinly populated concert hall. Indeed, punters had to be moved from the cheaper seats to more expensive ones to give it the appearance of being fuller than it really was.
Amid much grumbling from consumer groups about the ticket prices, Streisand called off planned shows in Rome and Nice. And, says Hunter-Tilney, she's not the only ageing megastar to face a fans' revolt in Europe this summer.
The Who and George Michael have both cancelled shows in continental Europe. And the Rolling Stones as well also came with something of a cropper in Paris lately when they played the Stade de France and were somewhat embarrassed to see it less full than they might have wished.
Another reason the ageing stars may not be getting what they want in continental Europe is that there are just too many of them on the road too often, says Neil McCormick.
There was a time when they had a rarity or a scarcity value, and I can remember as a young man it was like, oh, let's go and see the Rolling Stones, you might never see them again. Well, you know, a couple of years later, there you did see them again.
And again and again. He's seen them 5 times already. Perhaps the wandering megastars need to pay closer attention to the Bowie principle. When music becomes too readily available, people are less prepared to pay for it. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note at a time when stock markets have had more than their share of troubles. If you thought the IPO market had tanked along with subprimes, check out ticker symbol VMW on the New York Stock Exchange. VMware, that's the company name. It makes virtualization software, stuff that can mimic hard drives and more expensive mainframes, and so let IT departments cut way down on their expenses. VMware is the hottest initial public offering of the year so far. Shares shot up 76% today. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 207 points, 1.5%. The Nasdaq dumped 43 points, 1.7%. The S&P 500 dropped 26 points. That's about 1.8%. Thanks today to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. Next time on this program, consumers who are shouldering the weight of a supersized mortgage market.
There's a lot of working class families that are trying to purchase homes for $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, up to $1 million. Those are the families that I worry about.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.